We're gonna move to a larger now, much larger population of objects. So it's quite amazing when I see this plot, and each time I give a conference, there's more of these, I don't know how you call that, confetti in French. So I'm gonna talk only of a fraction of this vast population of planets, which is the ones that are transiting. So I'm not gonna discuss also the other planets that are further away, in particular the direct imaging objects that are also very interesting. You can see that it is limited to, well, the left hand of the diagram at short orbital distances, yet we do have a real variety in masses and also now in orbital distances between all these transiting planets. So the colors are the different metallicities of the parent star. So you can see that there is a variety in metallicity, and actually the size of the plots of the circles are related to the mass of the parent star. So another way to plot this diagram is, of course, for transiting planet, we have information on the radius. And you've already seen that. We have this kind of diagram where we have all the gas giant planets over there. They have sizes that vary, but they're not random. Of course, we don't have planets over there that we think we understand. It's because it's very difficult for core accretion or any other mechanism to form massive planets out of rocks or ices. We don't have planets to the top over there. It's because they contract rapidly. And then we don't have planets there because, well, we're not sure exactly, but where the limit should be. But definitely, it's because it's hard for hydrogen and helium to stay around a core that is of small mass. These planets are too loosely bound. Okay, so that's for the overview. I will discuss first the principle of the evolution of giant planets. And then I will focus my presentation on what I call the radius anomaly problem. And you will see that there are lots of different theories that give headaches to not only observers. And I'll try to show you that we can apply some statistical tests and that these theories contain some predictions, although you cannot necessarily decide right away with one observation that one theory applies or not. And then, if I have time, I would like to discuss the special case of Corot2b. Okay, principle. So there are a series of reviews on that by different groups that I invite you to read if you want to know more. But basically, I started the presentation, I didn't know about this talk, with an HR diagram for planets. So this is the evolution track, actually, of a planet like Jupiter. Of course, it applies only to planets that are mostly made of hydrogen and helium. And we believe it's the case for the majority of the giant planets that have been found so far. And what we discovered while I was working in Tucson is that 51 peg needed to have hydrogen and helium, but also it would depart from the usual Hayashi track that Jupiter should follow, namely a fully convective evolution path, because of the strong irradiation from the parent star. The planet is so close to its star that it's heavily irradiated, and it cannot contract and cool and stay at the same time fully convective. So it develops a radiative zone that allows it to continue to contract. And you have lines of constant radius that are there. Okay, and so these planets contract. And the closer the planet is to its star, or the more heated it is, the more radiative it should be. Anyway, these planets, even those ones, are mostly convective, but their external layer is radiative. This can be seen in this kind of diagram where you have the pressure inside the planet as a function of time. So the planet contracts rapidly, and a radiative zone, which is this hashed area here, develops. Okay. So giant planets that are made mostly of hydrogen and helium are quite compressible. They cool and contract. This is how their luminosity depends on their mass as a function of age for 1 giga-year, for 4.5 giga-years. And what I wanted to, what I wanted to point out is that the energy reservoir that they're using is the gravitational potential energy. And you can think of their luminosity as a function of time, as the energy divided by the time. So it's inversely proportional to time, this luminosity. But just what I want to point out is that contrary to stars, we have an eta factor here, which is due to the fact that a lot of the compression is used to increase the energy of the electrons that are degenerate. And in fact, the luminosity of these planets is mostly due to the cooling of the ions. And so it's a smaller fraction of the gravitational potential energy reservoir than you would expect for ideal gases. Okay. And then, as Dave pointed out, we can derive, and it's important, mass radius relations for a pure hydrogen helium planet that has evolved for 5 billion years. We have this kind of relationship with a maximum at around 4 Jupiter masses, something like that. Jupiter, Saturn, and more Uranus and Neptune are more condensed due to the presence of heavy elements. And we have transiting giant planets that are generally above that line, not all of them. And this is due, this is very well understood. It's due to irradiation. And I want to point out here that for these planets that are very close in, their sizes will depend a lot on whether they have heavy elements, in which case they may be small, relatively small, or whether they don't have any, in which case, you can see that they can have very, very large sizes. And sizes that are probably impossible to have. Something I've been asked to point out is that the relevant quantity really is not the density. Here we have objects that have, in the Brown dwarf regime, that are very dense. So there's nothing surprising in having densities over 30 grams per cubic centimeter. Really, the relevant parameter here is the radius that doesn't change or barely changes over three decades in mass, or at least 2 decades in mass. Okay. So now let's talk about the radius anomaly problem. All these predictions sounded quite good, and actually when HD 209458b was discovered in transit, we thought, well, we had we had predicted its radius. But it turns out that when you do more carefully the atmospheric calculation and you plug that into the evolution model, HD209, the first transiting planet, is too large compared to what you expect for a pure hydrogen helium planet. So it's even worse if you add a core. So that's what I call the radius anomaly problem. And I define the radius anomaly as the difference between the observed radius and the one predicted with a standard model for a pure hydrogen helium sphere. So now, to make a long story short, we have a bunch of planets. I mean, this diagram is a little bit old, but it's to make the point. A lot of them are too large. I mean, this is about one out of two planets are too large compared to what one would expect. So we really have a significant problem. So that's what I want to address. So here, when you have a planet that's too large, it means there's some missing physics. We can't. We need some additional energy source or something like that. When it's too small, actually, you can always say, well, there are more heavy elements, and then we explain. For example, this one has a 70 Earth mass core, and then you explain its size. Okay, now what can we do to solve that problem? I've divided the solutions into three categories. One possibility is to say that we should slow the predicted planet's contraction so that the planets remain hotter than one would expect, and that will yield the larger sizes. The second possibility is to take the energy that's incoming to the planet from stellar irradiation, and instead of letting it being absorbed in the atmosphere and being re-radiated back, which is quite inefficient, if you take a fraction of this energy and put it deep into the planet, you have a mean to keep the planet more inflated. And then there's a third possibility, which is to tap from the orbital energy of the planet. So if you have the planet slowly migrating, you have tides, then there is another energy source, and that's also a possibility. So let's first talk about slowing the planet's contraction. So that's what we believe heavily irradiated planets look like. You have a convective core, you have this radiative zone, and then you have, well, some complicated meteorology I won't talk about, and you have a day side and a night side also. I won't talk too much about that. So one possibility is simply to say, well, the contraction of this object is defined now not only by the atmosphere, but also by the thick radiative zone that deepens as a function of time. If you increase the opacities there, you slow the loss of internal energy, and so you slow the cooling. Okay, so that's one possibility, and it works if you, for HD209, if you increase the interior opacities by about an order of magnitude. Actually, you'd need a little bit more than an order of magnitude, a factor of 30 or so. So it's a little bit, it's completely ad hoc, that's for sure. On the other hand, we don't know so well where it's all the opacities at pressures of hundreds of bars and temperatures of 2,000, 3,000 kelvins. So maybe, why not? Another possibility is to consider the atmosphere. Okay, and the atmosphere is very complicated because of the day side and night side, because of the irradiation that doesn't have the same angle as a function of the location. We believe these planets are synchronized, but that some energy is transferred from the day side to the night side. Anyway, it's complicated, but it can be modeled either numerically or analytically. You can actually parameterize the whole thing by saying that you have incoming energy from the star and irradiation from the planet. The incoming energy is coming in visible. The radiation from the planet is at thermal wavelengths, although you're quite hot. And so the temperature in your atmosphere depends on the flux, the internal flux you have to transport. That's quite small. The irradiation flux, that's the dominant effect. And it depends, and the profile will depend on, and the temperature at deep levels will depend on the ratio of the opacity in the at thermal wavelengths and at visible wavelengths. So this parameter is a greenhouse effect parameter. If you allow incoming stellar radiation to penetrate deeper, you'll have higher temperatures deeper down. If you have higher temperatures deeper down, then the whole planet is on a different adiabat, and you can maybe explain its size. So, okay, this is the result of an analytical approximation, which is average over the day side and night side of the planet. I don't want to talk too much about that. And it's compared to much more involved calculations using all the opacity tables and radiative transfer. So you can see that there is already here some variability in the prediction of radiative transfer models. But generally, for these global averages for these planets, I mean, they're within 200 k of each other. Okay, so and this is a model, well, which included global circulation in the atmosphere, you know, for comparison. So our fiducial model is here, and that's what's being used generally to predict the evolution of these giant planets, in one flavor of the model or the other. And this is what you'd get if you allow stellar light to penetrate much more efficiently. So you decrease the visible opacity by a factor of 10, or you increase the thermal opacity by a factor of 10. It's really equivalent. Okay, so that's a way to make the deep interior hotter, and then to make the planet larger. Just very rapidly to show that it's really complex, this is what happens on the day side, where we have measurements of brightness temperatures, and various groups have attempted to model the temperature profile to account for the observations. The observations are here, I mean, are generally quite high up. Those are Spitzer observations. But you see that different groups obtain results that are quite quite different. Well, okay, so there is a variability there. So what do we find when we change this greenhouse factor? Well, if we increase it by a factor of 10, which is, as you've seen before, quite far from what's been predicted by current models, then we're able to explain the size of HD29458b. Okay, so this is actually something that has been that's been proposed a few years ago by Adam Burrows and collaborators. You can see here that this is the evolution of several planets. Please focus on the green curve here and the observation bar. This is for HD209. So we have this radius anomaly problem at solar composition in the atmosphere. but for 10 times solar composition, we're getting closer. So it's not exactly the same method as here, so the results are a little bit different, but the physics is there. Another possibility to slow the contraction is a very different model. It's been proposed by Chabry and Barraf. It's to have a layered convection. So it's what Dave explained for Uranus and Neptune. We may have a region inside these planets in which you have a compositional gradient, and so the heat inside is not allowed to escape easily. So what happens is that you have a low luminosity, so the planet stays very large, and maybe you can explain the observed bloated planets. Okay, so those were in this class of models. Then there's a possibility of transporting stellar irradiation energy deeper. So completely different class of model. The idea is that the planet is receiving about, 10 to the 29 ergs per second. So in a million years, you will have received about 10 to the 43 ergs. And compared to the binding energy of the planet, it's very comparable. So if you're able to have this energy penetrate deep into the planet, you can prevent its contraction, and you can even think of having a planet inflation. So this is a kind of model that we proposed with Adam Shulman a few years ago. The idea was that because of the day-night temperature difference, you'll have rapid winds in the atmosphere. And by the way, this was the prediction of the temperature map on the planet. And if you bring this energy deeper down and you dissipate it, then you can explain the bloated planets. But there's a big if. You have to transport the energy and you have to dissipate it. And for that, we had no estimates. And you can show, and it's been done by various groups, that when you do that, you actually, with about 1% of the incoming stellar energy, you do explain the size of HD209 and most other exoplanets, as we've seen. This was actually the principle was proposed first by Peter Bodenheimer in 2001. Okay, recently there's been a paper by Battingin and Stevenson proposing that ohmic dissipation could play a role, and actually this had been also proposed by Lane, Lin, and Dong. But in a slightly different context with just a stellar magnetic field. Here they propose, I don't want to go into detail, but that the meridional the zonal circulation induces a current inside the planet, and so it yields a dissipation of this energy. So it's a very similar model because you have to excite drive winds in the atmosphere through the stellar irradiation, and then dissipate it. And they're able to have this kind of dissipation rates, which is interesting. Okay, another class of models now, tapping from the energy orbital energy reservoir. In that case, so you have a potential energy which is in the orbit, which is of the order of 10 to the 44 ergs, so more, about 40. Factor 30 more than the binding energy. So if the planet migrates and loses eccentricity, this is a way to have it inflated. The spin energy from an asynchronous rotation of the planet is generally small. It's a factor of 300 below the energy in the orbit. So it's not very promising. So there's been a variety of works on that. I'm just showing these calculations for EG209, 458b, that show that you can have an inflation due to the high eccentricity, and then the eccentricity dies out, but the planet stays inflated, and you observe it by chance when it has a low eccentricity, but it still has kept memory of its former inflation phase. It's been actually also studied by Neil Miller, who is in the room, Jonathan Fortney, for many exoplanets. And their results are that, well, in some case you do, I mean, it helps, but it's difficult to explain all of the transiting planets that have been discovered so far. And there's also another paper by Jérémy Lecomte, and maybe in the discussion want to comment on that. I don't know. Where is Jérémy? Okay. So now let's move on to the statistical tests. I'm sorry I couldn't update that for the whole suite of planets that have been discovered in transit. So it's a little bit out of date, but again, this shows the principle. So this is again the radius anomaly, but this time I've plotted it as a function of equilibrium temperature. And you can see here, well, you have the missing physics and heavy elements there, but that there is a correlation. And so any mechanism that... Yeah. Three sigma. Yeah. It's very significant if you do the statistical test. It is. If you find a mechanism, it should explain that planets that are heated more tend to be more anomalously large. So you can do that. You can do the same calculation of the radius anomaly, but this time using a model in which the opacity has been multiplied by a factor of 30. In that case, you see that most of the bloated planets are explained, except a few of those here. But we still have a correlation in here. If you do that for the weather noise model, where you take a percentage of the incoming stellar energy, then it really looks better. There's no correlation anymore. There's also another correlation that is significant. It's the one in the radius anomaly and the metallicity of the parent star. Well, if you were not convinced of the previous correlation, you're probably even less convinced by this one. But I can tell you, it is actually a real correlation. And actually, if you clean a little bit the sample, you get closer to 3 sigma. But actually, you have it's a multiple parameter ensemble. So when you calculate, when you use if you calculate the mass of heavy elements that is needed, then it's even more correlated. Anyway, I don't want to enter the details, but okay. So what can we say about the missing physics? Okay. What I'm going to show there is whether any given model agrees in magnitude, in frequency with what is observed, whether it agrees in the orbital dependence that I showed, the metallicity dependence, and the age, whether it has an age dependence. So if you increase interior or atmospheric opacities, it's okay in magnitude if you have a large increase for factor 30, for example, in frequency, because you will say, well, it probably occurs for most of the planets. We've seen that the orbital radius dependence is not well, completely clear. There's a FE over H dependence that goes the wrong way compared to what I showed. So maybe, well, it's an indication that it's not the right model, or maybe it turns out that by chance it just happens that way, and that these planets have even larger masses of heavy elements. Okay, so this model maybe passes the test. The semi-convection model, on the other hand, in magnitude it's okay, but there is a problem that it has no reason to depend on semi-major axis. And it also has the wrong metallicity dependence. So I would say this model is ruled out. The kinetic energy model is working actually quite well. It doesn't predict any age dependence. And it's also more or less the case of the ohmic dissipation model, or the case of a model with thermal tides, mainly if you use the reservoir from the stellar photons, it's okay. Then you have models from the tapping the orbital energy reservoir. The obliquity tides are rare, so they're ruled out. I mean, it could happen, but not for most of them. And then the eccentricity tides, it may be okay, but it seems to be difficult because it's strongly dependent on age, and this is something we don't see in the data. Okay, I guess I will have to finish on that. Coro 9b is a consistency check. It's a planet that was mentioned earlier on with a period of 95 days, but it never gets very close to its star. So its orbital semi-major axis is 0.4 AU, and this means it's not affected by tides. And so the question was, should a planet like, if a planet like this is bloated, then we have to find a new scenario. But fortunately, it's not the case. This is a model with the planetary size as a function of age. Those are our constraints, and those are evolution model with no core and a 20 Earth mass core. So it seems to be a planet of about 0.8 times the mass of Jupiter that resembles our own Jupiter. And I'll end up with that.
All right, let's start the discussion.
I appreciate you looking at the statistical distribution of transiting planets to try to figure out which one of these scenarios might be viable. So one thing I worry about, and I know that you've actually worried about as well with work with François Francin, is selection effects in transit surveys, which actually can be quite severe. And so I worry that that some of these selection effects, you know, it's easier to find bigger planets around bigger, smaller stars, et cetera, might actually affect your conclusions that you're drawing based on these samples.
Well, we looked at that with François Fressin, indeed, and what we found was that there was no obvious selection effect between the predictions from just simply taking the radial velocity ensemble of discovered planets and having evolution models for all of these, and looking at the difference in the between the our predicted models and the observations, we were predicting exactly mostly what is observed. So at least for giant planets, we're not seeing the tip of the iceberg. It's I think we're seeing a population that is very well characterized. Now for smaller objects like Uranus, Neptune, and super Earths, it's a different problem. I agree.
Madhu Niku. So I guess I don't completely understand your opacity optical depth problem. First of all, I mean, what's the problem with having a 10 times higher opacity you could have? Is it primarily in the metallicities that you're concerned about, or is it in the like actual cross-sections that you're worried about?
Thanks for the question. Actually, if you simply increase the metallicity inside the planet, it doesn't work, because you're increasing the opacity on one hand, and that slows the cooling, but you're also increasing the mean molecular weight. So at the beginning, it may be okay, but rapidly, the increase in mean molecular weight dominates. So what I'm saying is that you need an ad hoc increase in opacity. And but for the atmospheric model, these things are so close to the star, you may have photochemical products. I mean, there are many ways to increase the opacities relatively substantially. And I think we learn a lot from the models, especially with the new Spitzer observations and all that.
So you're saying there is no problem with the increase in atmospheric opacities?
Well, we'll learn tomorrow morning whether it is a difficult problem, because I haven't done any comparison with the spectra. What I'm saying is ad hoc. I'm saying just, well, if we increase the opacities by a factor, by an order of magnitude, then it works for the evolution model, but it may be completely ruled out by the observations.
So looking forward to the sample we're likely to get with Kepler, a much larger number of transiting planets with accurately determined radii, masses will be require follow-up. Are there other ways that we can cut the data to try to, the subsamples, to try to distinguish these models? For example, you seem to favor the ways of taking the insulation and depositing some fraction of that energy deep, whether it's weather noise or ohmic dissipation. What do those models generically predict for the mass dependence at a given equilibrium temperature?
That's a good question. Well, the idea is that the energy is really obtained from imparting kinetic energy in the atmosphere. So it will depend on it will not depend too much on the mass, I would think, of the object, but it will depend on properties of the atmosphere. Yes. So that's right. So it's much harder to make a large planet inflated than a small planet, and that's why Corot 2b is so interesting. But it's too late, and you won't get to hear about that. But we can discuss it. There's no simple solution, simple answer to your question, but it's something to be looked at.
Why don't you go? I'll be quick. Jonathan Fortney. I just wanted to mention that the opacity issue is could be part of the issue, but it's really a 10 or 15% effect on the radius at most, and we have some planets that are 1.8 Jupiter radii. So even if there is an opacity issue, it's going to be a small part of some overall grander story of what's going on.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and in the case of Corot 2b, we have some strange individuals in the ensemble. So Corot 2b is one of them. It's a very young planet, and this may be part of the solution. I think it is. I'm sure there's not one solution to everything. It's a complex problem. We have to look carefully both the statistics and the individual planets.
My question was a little bit related to his as well. I was curious to know how does the radius corrections depend on how deep the energy is deposited in the planet. So, like for instance, the ohmic dissipation mechanism as an example, does it have to go deep? Can it go shallow?
Yes. It is dependent, actually. What matters is really the external radiative zone. So if you go deeper than that in the convective zone, then you've reached maximum efficiency. If you deposit it at pressures of 1 bar or less, there's almost no effect on the on the radius.
Very nice talk, Tristan. I'm going to talk a little bit very quickly tomorrow morning about some radius models, and I can, mm-hmm. can continue the conversation. One of the thing, but however, I don't think you need 10 times solar opacities to get HG2 and N450AB. I think it would be only about 3. And one of the reasons is the old age used to be about 5.5 gigayears. The new age is about 3.2 gigayears on average, but there's an age dependence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we put in the 3 times solar opacities, if that were associated with a larger molecular weight, we still get that the opacity effect dominates for a long time. For 10 solar, no. That happened immediately, as you suggest, almost immediately, the mean molecular weight trumps. But that the atmosphere effect, if you just increase the opacities by dint of metallicity and do it all the way through, tends to dominate for a few gigayears, and then it'll transition yes. over. It's a complicated issue.
Yeah, I agree fully. And this needs to be looked at. The thing I feel is that when looking at these correlation diagrams, because we have the inflated planets tend to be around the stars with lower metallicities, it seems strange to have a mechanism in which you have to increase the metallicity in order to have the planet more bloated. So it goes the other way. So that's why I would favor a mechanism in which you have an additional opacity source in the atmosphere that doesn't necessarily has to be correlated with metallicity. But there's no proof.
Okay, so Fred, this is going to be the last question from Andrew.
Yeah. Just I'd like to comment that the possibility that the thermal inversions that you heard about yesterday are possibly related to the issue of the inflated radii. Obviously, if you're absorbing lots of the starlight high up in the stratosphere, then less is penetrating below, and you know less ability to suppress convection. And so correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think this effect is included in the global evolution models, which might make the radius anomalies even worse.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, it would be an interesting work to try to see whether planets that are predicted to have temperature inversion are generally smaller than planets that are not, because there's some energy absorbed in there. I don't know if it's observable. It may be too small, but it's something interesting to look at, definitely.
Okay, well, I guess the rest of this will have to be moved to over our favorite drinks, whatever it's going to be. Let's thank Tristan and our speakers. And see you tomorrow.